This is GeekSpeak, recorded live at KUSP Studios, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business, full-time, part-time, and executive MBA programs, on the web at chicagogsb.edu.
It's Saturday, June 23rd, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, where's my flying car?
GeekSpeak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today, we're talking a bit about how technology has wonderful promises and how sometimes they don't come to fruition. During the second half of the show, I welcome you to join the conversation. You can ask us anything you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or contact us right now by going to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, a Slacker geek and student.
Good morning.
Sean Cleveland, technical marketing manager at NVIDIA.
Good morning, Lyle and Miles.
Good morning, Sean.
And also Alex Slias from Southern California. Alex, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you, Lyle.
Alex.
Hey,
good
doing,
morning.
Miles.
You know, it's Miles' birthday weekend.
That's right.
Yeah. I know that.
So one third of a century, Miles?
Something like that, yeah.
You don't look it. Okay.
See, I figure I'll wait a little bit, and then I'll have like the 33 and a third birthday.
Oh, yeah.
Just like Bonnie did. Bonnie was a really cool person to do that, think of that idea.
She's cooler than we are.
Yes. Definitely cooler than I am. I don't know about you.
Compared to Bonnie, we're geeks. I'm sorry.
So let me see if I can segue from your birthday to stuff that's been promised but didn't come to fruition. Well, kind of like how you dropped out of school. Some technology... That was bad, I know. I'm grasping straws.
He had a third life crisis.
Yeah, happy birthday, Miles.
So I... earlier in the week, someone sent me this great article from the BBC about how technology just could be a lot better. And one of the examples in the article, and I'll link it from the GeekSpeak site once it gets up again... One of the cases is why does software have save buttons? I mean, of course we want to save our work, you know? So this got me thinking this idea that there are things we take for granted in the technology we use that's pretty dated. What was another great example?
I don't know, the save button I have mixed feelings about because before, I mean, really there are times where you don't want to save. You're trying something out. You're checking out a setting to see if you want to try it and you want to revert back. So really it's been that whole fear of you're losing information.
Right, but what I'm
That's
saying
kind of
is,
a real thing.
Most of the time when you're editing a document, you know that you do want to save it. You're doing work, so regularly it's the default state should be saved.
Well, no, you always want the thing that you want to have happen.
I get what you're saying. You're talking about saving revisions as you go, and then you try something. But there's always an undo button. Why isn't undo built into the application? So you save your document, and next time you open it, you can still undo. There's no reason not to.
I guess I'm thinking
that.
Of more than just a document, though. It could be any setting in the operating system.
I agree with that. I hate that about Microsoft Office 2003. Word, if you save your document, you lose all your undos. Right. You notice that?
That's silly.
So you're doing all this work, right? And of course, you want to save every now and then. I do this Alt-S, you know,
yeah.
Save all the time. Boom, boom, boom. But when you do that, you've wiped out all the undos, all those levels of things, the changes that you've made. And then it's just so dumb. I have not figured that out.
No, most applications, when you save, they figure, oh, well, this is a starting point, so we'll just blank out.
Oh, no. I mean, most of the applications I'm using are code editors and the like.
Do they keep the undo even if you close the application?
Almost always, they have an option to say whether to clear the undo list or not.
So in any case, this started me thinking about all these technologies that we thought we'd have. Like, the flying car is a perfect example. You know, there was this idea that we'd have a flying car at one point. There isn't a flying car. Rick was just saying, Rick does the phones.
No, they exist. They're just, you know, a couple $1 million.
Sure. Rick was saying that when he was 14 or something like that, he flew in a jet, and really, they're the same technology, and that was, 40 years ago? Why is it that this happens? Why is it that we have amazing, a whole bunch of people working on stuff and amazing ideas, but nothing really changes, or it doesn't change very fast?
I blame the deterioration of science and math education in the U.S. schools.
Good. Alex, what's your thought on this?
I don't know. I mean, I think there's a number of reasons. I mean, a lot of it is trying to cater to everyone and anyone that needs to use their application. I mean, that's part of it, is you're trying, you know, a lot of times developers, and I don't mean just programmers, but people involved in the development process are focused on certain types of users, and you know, they don't think about a lot of others, or they put more focus on one or the other. So I think that's one reason. And I think another major reason is that you have people who, or you have developers that are basically trying to maintain, or you know, stay compatible with things that are already prevalent. An example is the iPhone. I recently saw a post on Slashdot about it, where they're asking, you know, website developers, will you be changing your website to, you know, to be more compatible with the iPhone, because there's certain limitations to the interface. You know, you can't have mouse or hover overs, you know, where you kind of mouse over something and you know, there's a little tooltip that jumps up, because there's no concept of that kind of mouse over on the iPhone.
Okay. Because it's a touch screen. There's no dragging across the screen most of the time.
So you got certain limitations, and here the iPhone is trying to do something new, but now they're kind of bumping heads with the way the rest of the web works and the way they were, you know, a lot of that direction went.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying, but do you think of the iPhone as an innovation of some kind, or just another small step?
I think it is an innovation. It's trying to break out of a lot of the concepts we know for some of the interfaces, or at least trying to make it more usable.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, most people have kind of grew accustomed to how certain things work, and now you have to get used to that. And you know, now it's just. So, I think it's just representative that there is a problem, you know, or a difficulty to overcome.
So user experience backwards compatibility is also an issue, where if you change things too drastically, people will feel lost.
Right, but let's call a spade here. The iPhone is not the first cell phone to have a web browser in it. This has been an issue before, where people have just ignored it before. Now it's becoming, the iPhone has had so much hype behind it, people are expecting its usage.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's a little bit of what I want to talk about. We keep talking about this. We'll invite people to call in about 15 minutes. You're welcome to share your frustration of a technology thing that you thought was going to be a little bit better and isn't.
And let's talk about not just you're frustrated or upset, but, you know, what do you think we can do to change that?
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of this has to do with habits, right? You get used to doing something, and you don't realize there's something newer or better out there.
You know, the cell phone industry is a great example of this. There's a lot of issues with cell phones that all of us kind of are aware of. We've all had, you know, anyone has a phone and knows the real frustration they have with their phone. But we as consumers aren't organized enough to say, this needs to be fixed. And voicemail is a great example of that. We have these phones that have all these multifunctionalities and everything, and yet we don't know what our voicemail is except for how many it might be. And we have to call some number.
But a lot of us don't. So many of us have carriers that don't have a wide variety of phones, don't have the same features.
Right.
So they may just be unaware of it. And anyone who's traveled overseas knows that we're way behind in cell phone technology.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
It's horrible the way like messages work. You say, I want to save this message, and it says, well, this message will be deleted in 14 days.
Right.
Like, all right, why don't I have more space, you know?
I love it.
And why can't I forward that message to a to-do box,
right,
so that it's work, you know, it's to-do? Or why can't I forward it to an email as an attached voice message that I can listen to now, at my desk
now,
or
the
something.
Thing is, in a consumer market, like in the market that we have, don't you think that our desires for things should influence the market so that we get what we want? I mean, that's the idea behind it, right? So why is it that we're in this situation?
Well,
is it
assuming there's competition. Remember when Ma Bell was broken up years ago, and now
they're all glomming together again?
Minus what, Verizon and one other company, AT&T's back together again. It's as though nothing happened
in
the intervening 20 years.
People want cheap service, right? And they want free cell phones. And they don't want to pay for internet connectivity. I mean, who's supposed to pay for all this innovation, right?
Yeah, I guess. I just think that the software on the phone is pretty pitiful. And the service in general. It's not, it's the same. I had a phone in 98, I think, or 97. And that's 10 years, and it does exactly the same things. The only thing different is now I do have a browser, which I don't use on my phone. And I do have a camera built in.
You know,
but the functionality.
What's the reason why you don't use the browser on your phone?
Well, the service costs too much money.
I pay a small monthly fee and get unlimited.
And do you use it?
I use it as much as I can. I use it every day.
Now, when we go to films and stuff, sometimes you check
I can check my GeekSpeak email, my personal email. I can surf the web. I get movie times when we're out. You've seen me do that.
Yeah.
Or if we're looking for more information about something, or if I need directions, I put Google Earth on my cell phone. Yeah.
Does it work?
Google Maps.
Google Maps, yeah.
Yeah, it works great. I am very impressed. I can do driving directions from anywhere, and it just connects up and gets all the data I need. And
all right.
I can zoom in on it. I'm really impressed.
Let's do a little bit of news before we invite people in to talk more about this. Miles, first news story, sir.
Sure.
We're doing things backwards today, but no one knows that except for me, who keeps track of things like this.
Well, here's a bit of good news. I'm usually doing some pessimistic news about the state of politics and
usually?
Technology. Well, it's true. At the same time, this one, I'm happy to report that internet email, according to the 6th District Court of Appeals located in Ohio, has stated that internet email is protected by the Fourth Amendment, that we have as citizens, we have an expectation of privacy with email, and that should be respected in much the same way as with telephones and standard mail.
What state is this?
This is federal court. So this is the 6th District Appeals Court.
Okay.
But physically or geographically, it's located in Ohio.
Do you know more about the case? Is it someone that was targeted from the government, and then they said, hey, this email is actually Fourth Amendment protected stuff?
An Ohio man, his email was searched after his internet service provider was ordered to turn it over to federal investigators. And they were also told not to tell him that they were looking.
Interesting.
At it. And they won an injunction against the government last year in U.S. District Court. Now it's been upheld in the Circuit Appeals Court.
Okay. So basically, privacy being protected. Good thing. We don't hear that much news about that. All right. Thank you
very
much.
We'll see how it goes when it goes to the Supreme Court. I'm pretty sure it would go.
All right. Thank you very much, Miles. Sean, you got a news story for us?
Seagate, which is my favorite hard drive manufacturer.
Local.
Because they're local. And also, they make extremely quiet and fast hard drives. They just announced a new mobile drive for extreme environments. It's the first terabyte hard disk drive that's in a mobile form factor. It's 5,400 RPM. I just wish they could get the faster speeds into a mobile footprint that doesn't use as much energy. But, you're spinning platters. I just don't know what they can do to not use so much power.
They got a terabyte laptop hard drive, but it's 54 RPM.
Yeah.
5,400 RPM. Well, that's pretty impressive still. I didn't know that they were getting that big. Is that already on the market, or is that something
No, I'm sorry.
Oh.
It's 80 gig extreme environment for mobile. God, I thought that was crazy. They just shipped their terabyte desktop hard drive.
Okay, good.
This new one is, it's supposed to...
It's
supposed to work in -30 to +85 degrees Celsius, and it can survive humidity levels of 90% and operate up to 16,400 feet above sea level.
Wait, 90% humidity levels? That means you can take a shower with this thing?
16,400 feet. I guess planes go that high.
Yeah, I'd say that.
Is that bad then if you're using your notebook in a plane?
If you're, no,
You know what? The plane's pressurized, though. So I guess this would be an unpressurized plane at 16,000. Maybe you could take it to the top of
a
mountain
pressure,
and be okay.
If you lost pressure on a hard drive that doesn't have, most of our hard drives don't.
So the airplane's pressurized, you're fine. But if you wanted to climb the Himalayas, let's say, you might want to take one of these hard drives.
Okay, so they also, Seagate also, that is a big news, is that they did release their first terabyte hard drive.
Yeah, Hitachi was the first company.
Sure.
Terabyte hard drives. Wow.
Now, do you feel safe having terabyte hard drives?
Is that something you want?
Or don't you want a RAID with, 300 gig hard drives?
You know what? I learned a lot about RAID this last week.
How so?
Did you know you cannot make, this is Windows. I have no idea what's going on in the Mac world, right? But of course, all their hardware is sealed and you can't do anything anyway. But anyway, with the Windows, you can't have a larger than 2 terabyte RAID array in Windows XP. It doesn't support it. You have to have Vista. And you cannot make, in Vista, if you create a 2 terabyte or larger RAID array, you can't make a bootable because that support won't be available until Windows Server 2008. Because the type of partition you have to create, which is GPT, doesn't support bootable. So if you wanted to buy, let's say, 4 of these terabyte hard drives, put them in a RAID 5 array, which means you're losing the space of one drive.
Mm-hmm.
But if one of the drives fails, any of the drives fail, you're okay. You have to use Vista.
Or use Linux.
And make a NAS, a network storage.
Would OS X be able to do it?
I don't know, actually. I haven't tried doing
that. That's a fine question.
I'd like to know. If anyone knows out there,
if anyone wants to buy me 5 terabyte drives, I'll try it out. All right. So we've heard from Miles. We've heard from Sean. Alex, got a news story yet, sir?
Do I have a news story?
I know I kind of surprised you by inviting you on air quickly, but I appreciate you being available.
Yeah, I've been frantically looking. I'm like, okay, what would be newsworthy? But here's something that might be at least interesting to those who are in the security world.
You know what? You stay on that for just a second.
Yeah.
Read that thing, Miles, would you please?
Tomorrow evening at 7, KOSP presents Another View with host Paul Couture. Another View brings you news, voices, and opinions you won't hear in the mainstream media. This week, a talk from award-winning journalist Jeremy Scahill. His latest book is Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. That's Jeremy Scahill, Sunday at 7 on Central Coast Public Radio.
Thank you so much. Alex, you ready for news?
All right. So, for people who kind of watch in, in security, I'm sure a lot of people know what penetration testing is. It's kind of where you might have a website or some software, and you have another tool that basically, or even a human person that goes and does this, but goes and attacks this website or attacks the software to try and find where there might be holes that they can penetrate into. Well, there have been a few major players in the market for tools like that. And it seems the larger companies are buying them up. Spy Dynamics was one of the companies that made a really good tool, and it seems HP has acquired them. And another similar tool is AppScan, which has been bought up by IBM. So it's kind of interesting to see what the big companies are planning to do with this. I'm hoping they don't ruin them because they're really good products, and they do help a lot in some aspects of security.
Do you use them?
We have not used them yet in our group. We've been reviewing a lot of them, so we're looking to use them. But now that there's been some of these major shifts in the products we've been looking at, we're kind of wondering or hoping that those tools will still be around.
Okay, cool. Thank you very much for that story. I appreciate it. Miles, let's go to you for the next news story, sir. You're in the loop.
The next story is apparently ISPs have been injecting ads into their customers' websites. Into their pages.
How would someone do that?
When you use what's called a transparent HTTP proxy. HTTP proxy. Right. Sorry about that,
it's
folks.
Okay.
And what that does is instead of making a direct connection to a company's web server, what you're doing is you're making a connection to an intermediary server, and it's making the connection for you, hence the term proxy. Now, what that normally a proxy, all it's doing is performing caching. In other words, making things faster, reading the information faster, distributing it out.
I mean, one of the ideas behind proxying is that if you visit a website and I visit the same website and we're the same from the same ISP, the ISP catch contacts the website once, and you and I get more of a local copy of that
right.
page. So that's one of the reasons for proxy. So there's a few of
or
those.
Or a reverse proxy. In other words, you can upload your website to a single server, and then they can have multiple servers that are caching the content to get the information out faster.
Right. Okay, so the idea, you can use these proxies for lots of things. If you have a proxy in the middle, an ISP can actually modify the pages that the person's visiting?
Yes,
is that
they
how
can.
They would do this?
Right. So they're parsing the HTML, that portion, the code behind a web page, and they're putting in little pieces of JavaScript and items that will put an ad in.
Hmm. That seems to me that if you know, some website, like, I don't know, geekspeak.org, does have some ad or something, and then the ISP that reads the page changes it before the user sees it, aren't they modifying a copyrighted thing? Isn't that an issue of copyright?
That would be something that comes to mind for me.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't. This is only something that people are starting to hear about. Apparently, some, but it has been fairly well shown that many ISPs are doing this. I don't know of any in the area per se, but.
So, out of curiosity,
but there are providers that are doing the service, that are advertising to ISPs, hey, we can do this thing that can put in a whole bunch of ads and then give you ad revenue for no effort really on your part.
So they're actually going through and modifying the existing page, not like intercepting and putting up, you know, like a little JavaScript pop-up over the page or anything. They're actually modifying the page.
Right. While the page is in transit, they inject a little bit of HTML, a little bit of JavaScript code snippet.
That is just truly disturbing.
That is really disturbing. I agree. I think that's, there seems to be a lawsuit waiting to happen here. Are you saying that a lot of companies are doing this? Are they big ISPs or small?
That I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Just people started noticing it on the net and talking about it. So if you have a website, go there and check out. If you
From
see
different
an ad,
ISPs.
Right. If you go, well, no, it's not that. It's the ISP that is hosting the website.
Ah, so you're talking about like one of these free web hosting providers possibly doing this kind of thing.
Possibly. Actually, what they've been talking about is it being something that you're paying for the service. You're paying for your web space,
okay,
but they're doing
okay.
this anyway.
So I thought you meant dial-up ISPs.
Oh,
you're talking
no,
about
no,
the
no.
hosting
okay.
providers. So now that's different because, of course, if I make a relationship with somebody to host my website and I sign some contract with them, that contract might say, we have the ability to change your website. And if that's the case, then there's no legal action that can be
Most people weren't expecting it, though.
No,
I don't know of
imagine.
Anyone who's...
I wouldn't expect
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I'd be certainly
that.
Upset. But
there
I mean,
was some...
That's a whole different thing than like the dial-up ISPs, the people connecting, having those ISPs.
Yeah, Miles, you made this sound really scary, man.
Well, that's why I brought up the reverse proxy, because this affects reverse proxies, not a
forward
proxy.
So you definitely want to, if you're hosting a website, you definitely want to check, make sure the content that people are seeing is the same as what you expect.
Right, and you would see that just by browsing your website.
All right. Thank you very much, Miles, for that. One more news story. Mr. Cleveland.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting. It's about Blu-ray, and we're going to have Sony on next week, next Saturday, to talk about Blu-ray. We actually have a rep coming into the studio, so it should be really cool. But there's a new content protection scheme called BD Plus.
That Did you
is
say BD or DB?
A BD. For think of Blu-ray disc.
Okay.
BD. BD Plus. It's supposed to strengthen the Advanced Access Content System, which is AACS, which is their digital rights management. What this means is their copy protection is getting a little stronger now. As you know, their copy protection was cracked, and people were able to actually take a Blu-ray disc and rip it. HD DVD too, by the way. They both use the same digital rights management. And save it to their hard drive. But Lord knows, I don't know why you'd want to do that, because you're talking like 20, 25 gigs of data. It's not like you're going to put on your portable device, right, and watch it in high def. There's a lot of stuff. You got a lot to talk about next week, but I wanted to talk about the way that they're doing it. BD Plus is a little more complex. It uses an embedded virtual machine inside player hardware to run executables that are on the Blu-ray disc, and these executables perform specific content protecting functions, like me running diagnostics on the disc player to make sure it's not been modified or that the actual encryption keys have not been changed.
So the discs themselves will have copy protection.
We'll have software to thwart copy protection.
So you can
that's run in a virtual environment.
Okay, that's pretty cool.
That's really advanced. And they can also swap out keys. So if it detects that a key has been compromised, it just changes the key, and then all that work that the hacker put into cracking that key, because that's how they do it now. They crack it. They get it from memory.
Wow. Wow, this sounds pretty advanced. Yeah. Is this actually going to be implemented, or is this something that they're thinking about?
No, no, it's going to be implemented. It's really serious because Fox, and which you know owns the Star Wars movies, and MGM, which owns the 007 catalog, have not issued a Blu-ray disc since April because of all of this copyright protection issue, the DRM cracks. So it's really important that, Blu-ray step up and take care of this. And now that Blockbuster Video is now backed Blu-ray specifically.
Mm-hmm. Or exclusively.
Exclusively, yeah. Yes. You know, this really puts a lot of pressure on them to make sure that this stuff gets fixed.
Let's keep talking about this because I think it's good to get some foundation for next week's show as well. But first, let's I need to do a little station business. Miles, you've got something. I'm sorry. Thank you so much. You know what? Here. You read that. The beauty of radio.
Right now?
Yeah, go for it.
KOSP co-sponsors Renaissance and Modern, a presentation by the Santa Cruz Chorale. Here the chorale perform Palestrina's Pope Marcellus Mass. Interspersed with movements of Mass will be four motets by one of the Bay Area's most celebrated living composers, Kirk Mitchum. Don't miss this exciting choral event on Saturday, June 23rd at 8 p.m. and Sunday, June 24th at 3 p.m. at the Holy Cross Church on High Street in Santa Cruz. For more information and tickets, please go online to santacruzchorale.org.
You're listening to Geek Speak. We are now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 476-2800, 476-2800, or toll-free anywhere in California, 1-800-655-5877. Of course, if you'd like to go to geekspeak.org, you can contact us that way as well. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry. Using digital technology for less radiation, offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. Stay tuned with KOSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio. This is Central Coast Public Radio. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland, and via phone from Southern California, Alex Leas. And you can join us right now. Ask us anything you'd like about technology. Of course, if you've got frustrations or solutions to technical woes, please join us with comments as well. The phone number is 476-2800. Again, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. So, Blu-ray technology, they're enhancing the DDR. Alex, I want to ask you, because you know a little bit about security, have you been reading up on this enhanced DDR for Blu-ray discs?
Not really, actually. I haven't been following a whole lot about the HD and DVDs and all. I've just been waiting for them to figure out what they want to do so I can start buying them.
Yeah. Well, see, it makes sense for Sean, because, of course, Sean, you were able to get this sample Blu-ray player.
Yeah.
Can you tell us how it's been worked for you?
Yeah, Sony sent me a Blu-ray drive, a computer drive, not an actual, you know, home theater player. This actually I put into a media center computer that I built to hook up to my TV, because I wanted to not only use it to play Blu-ray movies, but I wanted to be able to record data to it and play with that.
Oh, and so it's a burner.
And don't ask me how that works, because I'm going to do that this weekend.
But it is a burner.
It is a burner, too. And Verbatim sent me some data or some blank discs to play with, so I'm really looking forward to doing that. Backing up 25 gigs worth of data.
On one disc.
On one disc.
Sounds nice.
And then giving it to my daughter.
And letting her play with it?
Let her play with it and see if I can still read it. So
just don't give it to your dog.
Yeah, really. Huh? So I've got this for a month. I've had it for maybe just a few weeks now, and it's been playing great. It's amazing. I can't see ever buying a DVD again. I mean, I don't own this drive. I'll have to send it back. So I have to start thinking about how I'm going to get a drive. Because frankly, I just don't want to buy DVDs anymore.
Yeah.
I want to buy Blu-ray discs. It's just that much better.
Well, one of the great things is that with this thing, you're able to rent or buy Blu-rays.
Yeah, you can. Everyone rents them now. Netflix rents them.
And use your full resolution of your TV.
Yeah,
right?
Use the full resolution of the TV. It's really amazing. Yeah, which is, you know, twice what you're seeing with the DVD.
Of the quality.
Yeah.
We're talking, and
actually,
now,
it's more than twice.
Are Blu-rays doing 1080i? Or just
720? Oh, yeah, 1080p.
And yeah. Have you seen a 1080p disc on this yet, or have you, do you know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to see
you
that.
You saw it.
Which one?
Pirates of the Caribbean when he came over.
That,
remember how that looked?
It was amazing.
It was picture perfect.
I sound like, I'm going to sound like such a curmudgeon right now, but I really didn't see the big deal.
Let me see. He's on mic three, and Miles is out. The power. All right, we're going to start taking calls. From Big Sur, Jim, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Jim. What's your question today?
My first question is this. It's time for me to upgrade computers, and the question is what's a Mac going to give me that a PC isn't going to give me for the extra cost? But before I ask that question, you guys were talking about ads. Yahoo email is placing ads on our email pages now.
Right.
Really ticks me off, and I guess there's a class action suit.
So you mean that when you're reading your email through Yahoo, you see...
You have a big display bar across the top. It pushes everything down. And if you go down the page in your email and you delete something or save something or whatever, you don't stay working where you were. It pops you back up to the top. I do not want ads on my personal communication space, and I've called them, and I've emailed them, and I'm going to, I'm going to switch. I got to get a new email carrier.
Okay. Is this the free Yahoo account or the pay for?
This is paid. This is DSL. I mean, it's AT&T DSL, and they're of course hooked. You get your email through them through Yahoo Mail.
Okay, so I'm using the Yahoo Mail beta. Have you tried using that?
Do I need to do that?
Well, the beta doesn't have the ads that you're talking about. The ads for the beta are over on the right. In the Yahoo Mail beta, you get more of like a, you get some tabs across the top, and it's not taken up with ads. So I would definitely give that a shot.
Does that cost a little more?
No, it doesn't. Actually go into your account. You can, somewhere in there, you're going to be able to find the beta, and you say, yes, I do want to.
I can switch myself. I don't have to call them or anything.
No. You should be able to switch yourself.
Excellent. Okay.
So the first question, though, remind me again.
Okay, here's the thing. I'm a landscape photographer. I've got a six-year-old Sony LX800, which I love, but, you know, I'm going from Elements 5 as a cataloging and editing program to Lightroom. And it's time. I'm going to have to calibrate my monitor and all that stuff, and it's time to make a move. So here's my question. What is a Mac, like a G5 or whatever's out there right now, going to do for me beyond what a PC will do for me, a PC of comparable, you know, memory and speed, for the extra money that Macs cost?
Okay.
First off, addressing the how much Macs cost versus a PC, be sure you're not comparing a bare bones, the lowest level of laptop that you can get for a PC, and then your typical Mac. Like,
no,
actually look to see what the features.
I'm talking about comparable speed and memory.
And you're talking about a desktop machine.
Well, I've been thinking of getting a good top of the line Mac laptop with a separate larger monitor.
Right, that's actually what I use.
Yeah, but it wasn't just the speed and the memory. Because, for example, I'm on a Mac laptop right now, and it has a webcam in the top bezel, and it has Bluetooth, and
it's got your DVD burner, and
right, things like that.
Dual layer and all that.
Yeah.
Okay, so are you a Windows user now?
Yeah. I've used both Mac and Windows over the years, but I've been using this for...
Well, let me put it this way. Let's say I was an independent photographer, and I lost my, you know, didn't have another job, and I had no computer, or I had a really old computer, and I was going to upgrade and buy a new machine. I would most likely get a Windows machine. But that has to...
It's so affordable.
I think it's more affordable.
Yeah.
But also because I don't mind spending the extra time to play with the operating system and manage it and be a geek and install antivirus and do all those things, because those things are second nature to me. It's not a big problem for me.
Right.
Now, in my work environment, I support a lot of people that have computers, and it's much easier for me to support the Macintosh users. I have less problems. I don't have to worry about the virus problems. So when someone comes and says, you know, what should I get? You know, like, I'm really glad my mother has a Macintosh, because I don't have to I don't have to deal with it as much.
Yeah.
So it really has to do with, you know, who you are to some degree. Now, Lightroom is going to work the same. I mean, it's going to be comparable in both environments. I haven't used Lightroom on a Windows machine yet.
Actually,
Sean, have you used Lightroom yet?
You know,
if you haven't used Lightroom, you've got to try Lightroom. It's amazing. They've got a 30-day trial. It's a worth it app. It's a great for management, library management. I do use Lightroom as my primary library manager on my Macintosh. On my Windows machine, I have another app that's really wonderful called phototools.com. In any case, iMatch. But it only runs on a Windows machine. So I'm hoping to switch over to something that's universal. Now, I don't know. I think that your cost... Here's the deal. Like, if you guys look at a Macintosh, and Miles and Alex, you guys, since you're both using Macs, if you take a look at buying a new desktop upgradable machine, the Macintosh Pro is the only thing you get. It's the old G5 case, you know, but it's an Intel Core 2 Duo. That thing, base price is like $2,500. And it doesn't have the top-line graphics card. It has a few generations, a couple of generations back. Why would you want to buy that when you can buy a $2,500 top-of-the-line machine comparable with the most recent graphics card? So it seems to me that that high-end stuff on the Macintosh environment is more expensive than their consumer line like laptops.
Well, here's one thing I would say that buying a Mac will get you that you can't really easily get with a PC. You'll be able to run both Windows and Mac OS X. At the same time, if you wanted to. You can't really do that on most PCs.
If you buy an extra license.
Does that really function effectively without problems if you're on a Mac and you're running a PC program?
Yeah, just this week I saw a guy on his laptop. I was pretty impressed with how well integrated they are, and the performance was pretty good.
Okay. Then,
and that's with the new boot camp, or is that with rebooting?
No, he actually was running it through boot camp with Parallels.
Oh, with Parallels.
Yeah,
Parallels is different than Bootcamp.
Wait, was he using Parallels or Bootcamp?
Well, at the time, he was using Parallels.
Okay, so Parallels is the new Parallels, rather, is relatively good at running at the same time.
How much is Parallels?
I think it's like $40.
$80, I think.
$80. But then you also have to get Windows, another operating system. I mean, you have to buy both of them.
Now, the other thing is, when you buy a Mac, you don't get in a bundle, you know, Office and Word and Excel and all that stuff, do you? You have to spring for the software, too.
Yes, you do. And that's true in a Windows environment, too. When you buy a Windows machine, you'll have to buy Word.
So if I get this straight, Parallels runs while Mac is running in the background.
Yeah.
And then you run Windows on top of that?
You can.
Yeah. On a notebook.
Yeah.
In your notebook. And
sounds
you can
actually horrible
run it,
to me.
You can run it where it actually gets rid of the Windows desktop and the applications run themselves.
Before my hard drive crashed on this machine, I had Parallels running and I could go into Windows. It was pretty cool. One of the things that's great is that you just save the state. You don't have to reboot Windows.
It's a file, right? It's virtualized space.
It's virtualized space, yeah. But, you know, the processor handles virtualization, so hardware.
Yeah, it ends up being, from what I hear, about two-thirds the speed of native.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't do it unless you have at least a gig of memory. Because there's nothing you can do. No virtual amount of virtualization is going to free up memory that's being used.
Well, here's a thought. Do any Macs currently come without a gig?
No.
The baseline MacBook Pros not come with two.
Yeah.
One last quick question. Do you guys who have Macs, do you run Aperture? I read some terrible, terrible reviews about Aperture, and that's why I went to Lightroom.
Yeah, I have not had a success. I mean, I used the beta of Aperture, and I played with it and everything, but Lightroom's just better.
Yeah, okay.
And that's my personal opinion, of course. And then, okay, thank you. One more thing. Rick sends us a little note saying, you know, if you've got a paid-for Yahoo account, you know, you got DSL through AT&T Yahoo, and they give you Yahoo, install a local client. So, like, on a Macintosh, it would be Mail, or on both of them, it would be Thunderbird, and connect their mail service through that. Then you won't have those ads, and it's just a better user experience.
Well, that's what I was thinking about.
Yeah.
I didn't know quite which one to do. You're talking about Thunderbird.
Thunderbird is our universal mail recommendation from the geeks.
All right.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Bye. That was Jim in Big Sur, and now we're going to go car. Sean's got a point, so go ahead. Sorry.
No, I'm going to help the next caller.
Oh, okay, good. Gotcha. So
good
Chuck.
Said everyone.
Let's start this all over. In beautiful Carmel, we have Chuck. Welcome to Geek Speak, Chuck.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Thank you for all your wonderful services to mankind.
Are you talking to us? No, what's your question?
Wow.
Hey, just to make it quick, I have over the years accumulated several different computers and haven't paid a lot of attention to keeping track of which particular copy of XP is on which computer. And I was trying to coordinate and organize all my stuff. And I would like to figure out which copy of XP is on which computer. Now, the folders for the disks, of course, have a product key number, but how do I find that on the computer so I can coordinate all this?
Go to magicaljellybean.com.
Are you serious?
Wait, Sean, did you even hear the question?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of jelly beans or something. Actually, there's a software company called Magical Jelly Bean, and they make a free utility called Key Finder that will tell you what your key is for your specific Windows.
That's Magical Jelly Bean, one word.
Yeah, magicaljellybean.com.
I'm sorry I called.
You can't make this stuff up, folks.
Okay,
that's good. And by the way, just as a matter of PC, if I may use that word, calling a spade, someone mentioned earlier, is considered by some folks as being a bit un-PC. You might remember that.
Sure.
I got trouble one time about that. Hey, thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, Chuck, for the call.
Miles.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, let me just clarify what that was. So basically, you got a few machines, you got a few boxes with XP. You know that Windows XP with the serial number has been used on these machines, but you don't know which is which.
Right.
That's a problem I run into,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
So, and then, of course, if you're going to reinstall or put it in a hard drive in and you need to reinstall, if you use the wrong key, then Microsoft starts seeing all these uses of the wrong software, and pretty soon they terminate your license. So there's a bit of an issue there. You've got to keep track of it.
It's just crazy. When I was in Indiana, no matter where I go, I'm helping someone with their computer, right? And this is relatives. So I'm in Indiana for a week on vacation, and I'm kind of working on computers. So I reinstalled Windows on a set of new... Actually, I swapped out a bunch of hardware in my relative's computer, and it said this version of Windows has to be reactivated because it appears it's on a new machine. Mm-hmm. It's the same machine. I just swapped out a few items, right? So they don't have high-speed internet. They had dial-up. So I'm like, oh, this is great. I can't figure out how am I going to dial up, and then this because the screen comes up before you actually get into Windows, right?
Right.
I want to have to call and give this long number and get it back. So I went through all of that, and then something happened. We ended up changing the motherboard, and it had me redo all over again. And I dug a little deeper, and I was able to actually connect up through dial-up before I got into Windows using their interface to do everything for me, and it worked.
Oh, that's cool.
So it took a little more persistence. It was not straightforward at all. It was horrible.
But your relatives did have the disk, and they knew which one is which.
No, I didn't. Yeah. I had the serial number, but when you put the serial number in, when you reactivate, it's this long number that has to be, you know,
right over the phone.
Over the phone, you have to give it and get it back.
Well, that's cool. So how what ISP did they use? Was it an 800 number, or did they use the ISP they were being provided? I mean, when you dialed up, did you use the ISP they were paying for?
No.
Was it like a toll-free number?
It's a toll-free number from Microsoft, and you actually connect to one of their modems.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Through an 800 number. So, yeah, it took a little digging, but it's possible.
So if you want your serial number that's an installed disk, in case you have these problems, magicaljellybean.com.
And you know what? If you put it in your serial and they won't take it,
Microsoft,
get an operator on. Get somebody real on the phone, because they'll want to throw you to an automated and say, look, all I did is swap out some hardware, and you guys aren't activating my code.
Yeah.
And, I thought I was going to have to fight with them that first time, and...
You're fine. But
she said, I'll give it this. Here's
Vista,
your number.
Isn't Vista saying, aren't they saying with Vista that you only get to do that like twice?
No, they got rid of that.
Oh, okay, good. Miles, you got a point?
Yeah, this was in response to the caller saying a spade, having...
Chuck, sure.
Having some issues. It's actually not an ethnic slur. Just wanted to make that clear. It actually derives from an ancient Greek expression, which was call a fig a trough.
Is that what Chuck was saying?
He was saying being PC. About it.
Oh, the term spade a spade could be
some people
racist
might take
concern.
Offense to.
Right.
But
and
you're saying
it
doesn't have
it
that
is,
generation.
It is. That is not its etymology.
Okay. So its etymology is from Greece?
It was originally a Greek expression to call a fig, a trough, and then in the Renaissance, Erasmus confused the word trough for a Greek word for a digging tool.
A spade.
And so then
shovel.
A spade is a spade. Call it what it is.
So we should really start just switching to fig a fig. That might get offensive.
I got just so everyone who's listening knows.
Yeah, thank you. One for me too, Miles, and I'm barely listening. Yeah,
I got,
Alex,
I got a quick question for, I guess for any of you, but maybe for Sean. In regards to actually getting the registration number, can you just go to my computer, right-click, and go to properties, and it tells you it right there?
Does it?
I don't know when it's
registered to list your name, and there's a big long number that I believe is the registration.
Yeah, but then you don't get to type in magicaljellybean.com, Alex. True. What kind of fun is that?
That's not the registration. That's not your serial number.
That's not it. Okay.
No. That's your unique identifier, though, I guess. Huh? All right, let's take another call.
Yeah, it's some sort of other identifier. Their serial number is five sets of five numbers.
But the code that you've got to go over the phone is 30 sets of 30 numbers. It's really long, right?
It's really long. It's the really activation long. Code is very different.
And then you're sitting on the phone going, it's X11771.
It's like nine sets of five numbers, nine or ten.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
From Santa Cruz, Mike, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Mike. What's your question today or comment?
Well, I'm thinking about optical media and how long we're going to be using it as a standard way to deliver content or create some very secure offline storage. So just looking for opinions on that. I'm in the business, so I'm just kind of curious about that.
So in what business?
Sorry?
In what business are you in? Are you in?
We manufacture hardware robots, basically, that automate the delivery of digital content onto the disk. Then we print it. So there's a whole bunch of uses for it.
So your robot manages the media as it's being pressed and printed?
Right. Well, it's not replication. It's duplication. So we don't press it, but we master and author it, and then we move it through the process from putting the content on it up to printing.
Wow! And then somebody else actually does the pressing of discs.
Right. So we get the media, or we sell the machines to people who then procure the media.
Right. Is this CD and DVD?
Ray as well.
Are you handling Blu-ray and such as well?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. So the question is, how long is your business viable?
Yeah. You know, there's all sorts of different ways to think about it. And there's a ton of different industries that sure. use those discs in different ways. But the hottest thing out there right now is, you know, MOD, movies on demand, and having that at a retail space, you know, taking the entire stock at a Blockbuster and putting it on a desktop and being sure. able to deliver that to a customer. You know, on their way to Vegas, for instance, they got screaming kids in the van and they want to pick up a DVD. They can pick it up for $4 or $5 and don't have to have a huge library.
All right, geeks. Your opinion on how long CDs and DVDs will be used before we just use the cloud? I would say, from your experience in your hometown of Indiana, that cloud's not going there. Your relatives have dial-up, right? So they've got to have CD and DVDs.
Yeah.
So we got a long ways before we have a universal internet that can do broadband.
And until we can figure out how to get the cloud to be anonymous, so that it isn't a central location that anyone can go and grab that information.
Because right now I can go to a video store with some cash and rent a film that I might not want to associate
with.
Right,
I don't consider the limitation to be technical so much as an issue of privacy and social.
Security, of course.
Right.
Yeah. I just look around the room and see all these CDs and go, there's no way this is going away soon. We know every week we come into this room that has, I don't know, 30,000 CDs around
And people are always mining these walls. For their show, right? And they want to know, they want to look at physical things they can stack up and look at. I mean, can you imagine if we didn't have any CDs here and it was all digital? We'd have to have stations for people to queue up their music. And I mean, maybe it's possible, but that's going to take a lot of work. We don't, there's a lot of work that's got to be done before everything goes digital.
I think you've got I would say definitely 10-year life cycle on CDs. DVDs, I think, are slowly going to get replaced by Blu-rays and stuff. But your Blu-ray drive reads DVDs, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Sean, your Blu-ray. Yeah. So I think that DVDs as
burn time slow, but...
Yeah. But I think CDs are going to be around for quite a while.
Well,
yeah.
DVDs, the burn time isn't slow if you're only burning a CD's worth. If you burn a CD's worth, it's going to be the speed of a burn.
No, I think
CD.
About Blu-ray. Blu-ray is...
Yeah. Because it's a different laser.
Right.
You know,
it's like four times as opposed to 16.
I think that
is a great question for Bob next weekend. Sony. Bob DeMoulin from Sony's going to be here.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
And he's been at Sony for like 12 years, a long time.
And his focus is Blu-ray.
His focus has been optical storage. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think he's going to have a lot of insight.
Well, we get constant questions about it. You know, when we evangelize this equipment and do, you know, a new vertical medical imaging, for instance, just starting to use the equipment. And then, you know, everybody scratches their head and go, God, how long are we going to be, like, it's some prehistoric technology, and why are we still using it?
Yeah. Well, you know, geeks, let me ask you guys. I mean, are you still buying blank CD media?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I still buy CD media? CD?
Not so much. I bought a pack of CDRWs, and that was it. I just reused them
if I ever
need a CD. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I bought a pack of DVD-Rs, which I use for storage and such, but occasionally I might have a use for a few blank CDs.
Yeah. I think that we're, it's definitely a tool. The wonderful thing has to do with these drives, that even when you get a Blu-ray HDV drive in your computer, it's going to be able to use and burn CDs and DVDs. So you're not getting rid of that functionality. And since it's such an industry of, I mean, so many people have CD players in their cars, that if you want to take your music into your car, and that's going to slowly fade out, but we're talking about a major reliance. And if any you know, HD radio slow move of moving, like we talked about last week, the same issue exists with CD players and DVD players. There's just a giant install base.
Yeah. You know, I see a lot of incompatibility with DVD media.
Yeah.
I seem to have much better luck when I write data to CDs, because I'm working on, I'm helping people with their computers, and I can't tell you how many times I've had to update people's firmware in their DVD drives so they can read
the most recent,
you know,
stuff.
My blink or my burned media.
I totally run into that problem too. People are always, you know, in a media environment.
Yeah,
like
they're,
I'm at work.
It's like they're
people
always
are burning
updating,
DVDs and then it don't work. And
they're
yeah.
always updating the ink or the dye
yeah.
in the media, because everybody owns their dye, right? So they always come up with something new that they can sell, and then your drive can't read it. Oh, it just drives
me
crazy.
Mike, you're totally safe.
Cool.
Thanks so much. I'd love it if you went to GeekSpeak and sent us an email, because I'd love to hear more about your company, maybe even an interview about robotics. I think it'd be really interesting.
Hey, do they talk?
I'm sorry?
Do the robots talk?
We're very close to that.
That would
Thank
rock.
You so much, Mike, for the call.
All right. Bye.
Bye. I think we'll have time for one more call from Aptos. Sheila, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Is there a Hoosier on board?
That's me.
All right. Fellow Hoosier here.
Right on.
And I'm calling because I'm pretty illiterate in the computer business, and I'm looking for a laptop, and basically what I'm needing it for is, you know, internet, PowerPoint, some presentation skills. And do most of those come with the DVD, the capacity to burn DVDs? And
it's all separate software
now?
Well, what, the hardware, Sean, most laptops have DVD
yeah.
burners.
Okay, so the hardware, yeah, they do. DVD rewritable drives.
Okay, and question is, I'm not real big on shopping. I'm pretty visual. I like to go kind of put my hands on the keyboard and look at it. Is if there really is any real validity to brands, or you know, getting the best value. Hopefully, by the next time around, I'll be more educated and ready to step up to the next.
You know, it is a difficult thing. It is a difficult thing because, of course, you go to an electronics store that has the laptops lying around. You have to really know your stuff to be able to compare them.
And I don't.
And you can't trust the salesman.
If I were to buy a laptop right now...
You buy a Mac. I know.
I might buy a Sony Vaio.
Vaio's a good... Well, do Vaios have DVD burners in them?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And so Vaio is V-A-I-O, stands for video, audio, in, out. And
Did you say D-I?
Oh, V. So think of video, audio, in, out. Take those letters, that spells Vaio.
Okay.
Yeah, I really like just the screens they use. They always have great features, more than you probably need. So you've got to understand it's a more expensive notebook. But if you're doing video type work especially and you want to burn, create DVDs, I mean, it's a great, great notebook.
And, you know, when I say DVD, I'm talking more audio this point.
You know, my one recommendation when buying a notebook is don't buy a consumer notebook. So if you go to Dell.com, you'll see they have a home section and they have a business section. Mm-hmm. I'd stay away from the home section because business notebooks are made better.
Yep.
And they often have better features. You'll pay a little more money, but they're more rugged. I've seen it, so many times.
Sheila, thank you so much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. The geeks this morning were... me, Lyle Troxell. That was Miles Elam. We also had Sean Cleveland. And via phone, Alex Slias. Geeks, thank you so much for participating today.
Thank you, Lyle. Had a great day.
Sean, go ahead and say a little bit about what we're doing next week.
Yeah, next week we have Bob DeMoulin. He's a product manager from Sony. He's going to talk about Blu-ray, drives, discs, technology. And we can talk about DVD, CD technology, too. This guy's an expert in optical storage. So I'm putting together an article that we'll have on GeekSpeak, so hopefully you can go there and take a look at that. And we can talk about movies and how these things will replace DVDs. We'll see.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP Santa Cruz, KBH San Otto. We're online streaming at kusp.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with superhandling all-wheel drive. More at acura.com/RDX.